This morning we looked at a few questions, and we were doing that practice breathing out into space. So breathing out in the out-breath and then resting in that spaciousness on the in-breath. And there was that comment that it feels different from focusing on the kind of energizing effect of the in-breath. Maybe one of the good things about practicing as we were this morning is that when you focus on the in-breath, very often there's a sense that it's coming into me and I'm taking it in. Whereas when you focus on the out-breath and letting go, and during the in-breath you just rest in that sense of spaciousness, there's less room for self-reference, if you see what I mean. So this afternoon, we ought to do one or two more questions. And we also need to look at the fourth reminder, don't we, to complete our set. So, oh yes. Here's a question that actually it sounded quite urgent. It was a bit of a cri de coeur, and I got it yesterday. So I really apologise to the questioner for not having said anything about it before now. Dear Vasantara, I've observed that one of the main pulls away from continuous awareness on this retreat has been obsessing about someone else on this retreat. Yes, been there, done that. Over the years. Particularly in the early days, I don't know what the average age of the order was when I was ordained, but it was probably still in its 20s, so there's lots of that. So thinking, whatever, aren't they great? Aren't they lovely? I wonder if they've noticed me. I wonder if they're in a relationship. So, yes. Can you say something about how to engage the members of the crowd that are interested in sex and romance? The best I seem to be able to manage is to contain it, not act on it, notice it. Well, sadhu for that. But it's very persistent. And there seems to be a lot of interest and energy there. Help! As I said, it's a cri de coeur, and it's one that I can really sympathise with. Sure, lots of us can at different times. There's a whole big topic there. But so again, we're just going to have a few headlines, which may or may not help. Let's see. But yeah, these things are very common. They're very well known. You get these sort of, what do they call them? On those sort of vipassana retreats, those sort of 10-day, completely silent, eyes-down retreats, they have a term for it. It's not a retreat romance, but it's something like that. Yeah, so on those retreats, you're silent from the time you close the taxi door or whatever. So you never kind of really engage with other people very strongly. Just you're encouraged to just get on with your practice. But inevitably, you do notice this attractive person sitting there. And in the course of this completely silent retreat, you know, you can build up all sorts of senses of what they're like and, you know, how great it would be. And sometimes you can have that real sense that, you know, although this is all completely silent, you know that they reciprocate. You know that there's something going on. You can just feel their energy, you know. And it kind of builds over the days, you know. You sort of feel there's this sort of tension there, and you kind of imagine, you know, all that's going to happen. And, you know, at the end of the 10 days, you know, the retreat kind of comes to an end, and you just go and kind of, you know, introduce yourself to them to see how their retreat was, and you discover that they're not interested in you at all, and they haven't noticed you even. They don't think about you, and the whole thing is a complete, you know, mental fabrication. Well, maybe everything is a complete mental fabrication, but it's a particular kind of mental fabrication. Yeah, you've just created this whole thing. And, you kind of built this great kind of fantasy. And, you've spent hours and hours, which maybe you could have spent, you know, with the breathing or whatever. Just in this world, and having done it at times myself in the past, it really made me aware how, you know, you say, oh, you know, I just fell in love. Actually, you don't just fall in love. I mean, Bhante talks about this at various points in the seminars. Actually, there's some initial something. You know, you see something. You think, oh. But then, you know, if you were just to let that go, that would just be another experience. It arises, it passes away. But what you do is you invest energy in it. Yeah. You kind of call the person to mind again, and you just begin to think, oh well, actually, yes, you know, they've got this quality and they've got that quality. And then you call them to mind again. And then again, and then again, and you build a lot of momentum, sort of focused on them. So, yeah, we tend to really work at falling in love, actually. So it's worth noticing that. So what do we do about it? Well, you can, with awareness, you can notice that it really is, you know, it's clearly your projection, because we don't really know what this person is like, and we don't know anything much about them. So we are interacting with a projection, a psychological projection, you know, with some anima or animus thing going on, to use those terms. And it's interesting to try to become aware of what the qualities are of that person that we're drawn to. I remember back in the early 80s being leading a group at Padmaloka. And we were talking about this area, and there was a guy in the group who said that, yeah, he was, as it happened, right at that time, there was a woman that he was very attracted to. And so the group kind of encouraged him to just feel into, you know, what it was about her, and he couldn't quite get to it, so we ended up saying, well, just imagine yourself as her. How do you feel? You know, what is it? And he kind of did that. And it kind of dawned on him that he was really attracted to how colourful she was. You know, she was, you know, she'd walk around in whatever, rainbow leggings and things, you know, so there was all this kind of colour. And as soon as he came out with that, we all kind of laughed, because there he was, you know, grey jumper, black trousers. So all that colour and richness, it was all going out there. You know? And in a way, it's great that it went out there, because it was a way of him kind of contacting something which he wasn't in direct contact with in himself. But then the difficulty is that it sort of gets stuck, you know, it gets put onto one person, and we feel like we don't notice that it's something of ourselves that's going out there. We feel, oh, it's them, and so then now there's this wonderful quality that's out there, so we somehow have to appropriate it and hold on to it. So yes, we can do that work of, okay, well, what is it, you know, about this person? What quality do we feel like, imagine that they have, and we can get into contact with that quality, and then, work our way into experiencing that quality directly. And again, in one of those early seminars, Bhante talks about how he feels a healthy person might fall in love, in a sense, quite regularly. But it doesn't get fixed. It doesn't get fixed on one person. It's like there's that sense of seeing qualities and thinking and being really drawn to them. But you recognise, oh, it's the qualities. Yeah? So the qualities could appear in this situation, in that situation, another situation. It really helped me years ago, again, when I was living at Papaloka. There was one spring where I'd been working in this area a bit. One spring where I fell in love with the garden at Papaloka. And it was just like falling in love. You know, it's like I'd be sitting leading a study group and I'd just be longing for the break so I could go into the garden. Yeah, it made me realise, you know, it was exactly that same kind of feeling. Just, I was besotted with the garden, very, very, very in love with the garden. Yeah. So, yeah, that's, you can look into all that, and there's lots of interesting things to discover, and lots of interesting qualities to discover. You know, it's usually the things that we're not in touch with directly in ourselves that we contact. And that's one of the ways, on a more sort of, perhaps not the deepest way, but one of the ways in which sadhana works. Yeah. We contact qualities and we see them out there. Yeah. And what we're seeing is qualities that are potentials that we can fully own. Yeah? But we start by seeing them out there as Manjushri or whatever, all that kind of clarity or beauty, whatever we see in Manjushri, strength, and so on. Yeah, by, as it were, projecting them, we experience them very fully, and then we start to own them. It's like we move from the visualization in front to a self-visualization. And then, I haven't got time to really go into all this, but there are ways that, you know, you work to kind of sublimate those feelings, you know, and refine them, which is another way in which the arts come in. There are various traditions where there is someone and you fall in love with them, but then you never see them again, like the troubadour tradition or something like that. So you have a kind of beloved, and you write fervent poetry which you don't send, and you compose wonderful songs which you sing, but the person's not there. And so again, that figure gradually becomes an internal figure and becomes a sort of muse and inspiration. So yes, there are ways in which you sort of take it onto subtler levels. And then you can just practice. So I keep using this word just. I don't know why I do it. You can just, you know, just practice, just gain enlightenment. You can practice what we used to call dwelling in the gap. I gave various talks about this back in the 80s, where there's contact and then there's feeling, and then the tendency is that that goes on into Trishna, into Tanha, into thirst, into grasping, craving, into craving. So, okay, you just bring awareness to that point. Okay, there's this person you're really, who's very, whatever you see in them, they have all these qualities, they look great, they feel like really, like they might be a really good person in this way. And here are you. And you just sit with that tension, which tends to build, that tension to move towards them or to pull them towards you. And you sit with that and sit with that and sit with that. Because what we always try to do is avoid sitting with that tension, sort of craving and aversion. They're all about the fact there's a tension between subject and object, and which in itself is a misinterpretation of our experience. But first we create that sense of subject and object, and then there's a sort of sense of the tension between the two, and that tension is dukkha. So now we want to resolve that tension somehow. So we do it either with aversion or with craving. We want to break that tension. So rather than doing that, we just sit with the tension, and it builds, and it builds, and it builds, usually, until you get to a kind of crescendo, and then something happens. If you just sit with it, it builds to a crescendo, and then it dies away. And also, you can just keep looking into the nature of the whole situation. There's some people very interested in that area at the moment, in the order. But it's always a good thing to be interested in. And then lastly, last quick headline, I guess, it would be something like, you can practice unhooking, which is, I've talked quite a bit about in the last year or two. Again, this comes from an early seminar with Bhante, where he was talking about how when you feel a strong emotion, you can go through a sort of three-stage process. So, okay, there am I very, very strongly attracted to this wonderful person who's going to completely make my life okay. And so first off, I unhook the feeling from the object. So I do my best just to let go of what it's about. This same principle with anger. If I'm absolutely kind of raging, then okay, because so-and-so did me wrong. I let go of the so-and-so who did me wrong. And I just, so now I'm, if it's craving, I'm just left with me with this very intense craving. So that's the first step, unhook from the object. Second step, you unhook from the subject as best you can. So you aim to let go of a sense of me that wants. Or me that's absolutely furious or whatever. You sort of unhook the feeling from that sense of a me that has the feeling, that's the owner of the feeling. If you can see through that, fine, but if not, you do your best just to put that on one side. And so we've gone from, I really want that person to I really want. And now there's just, where we left now, we're just wanting. There's just this strong, feeling, yeah? Or with rage, there's just this feeling, yeah? Whatever it is. So, and then the third step, which is kind of unhooking, is we even take the label off it. So now we don't call it wanting or craving or anger or whatever it is. We just experience what we're left with. There's just, as it were, the naked experience, which is just an experience of energy. Again, this I'm describing it like it's an easy thing to do, which it may well not be, but if we just get a sense of the process. Yes, you get the idea. So I've also been talking about this in terms of positive emotion as well. So with metta, you know, taking metta more into insight territory. And Bhante talks again about almost like that, you know, beyond sending metta to all beings, basing himself on the tradition and the Akshayamati Paripitya Sutra. There's a further stage where you move into a sort of objectless metta, and to do that, you let go of there being kind of beings that, you know, you're sending metta to. So you let go of the object, so to speak. So now there's just metta, you're radiating metta in all directions. And then you unhook from the subject, you let go of any sense of me sending metta or metta coming from this source of a center here. And so now there's just a field of metta. And we don't need to call it metta, we don't need to call it love, we don't need to use words. So there's just something that's well worth exploring and getting to. So that was the short version of a few possibilities that we could produce. But yes, it is good to just see that, you know, it is just a bubble, and we could spend days and days, and I have, I think, in the past, just getting caught up in something like that, and then you discover at the end, well, they are in a relationship. So, and then you kind of crawl off and what was the point of all that? Why did I do that to myself? Or whatever.
Sandra,
hello.
Would you say it's just because the mind is bored?
No, I wouldn't say it's just because the mind is bored. Although that's one way in which a bored mind can look for excitement. I think often it is, there may be some, as it were, boredom, which is stimulating, you're looking for something stimulating to happen, which all actually comes back to wanting to maintain yourself, a sense of self, and it's easier to keep a sense of a self and an ego when there's big emotional things happening. If I'm really angry, I feel like I'm really here. Or if I'm full of passionate sort of love. There's a very strong sense of me in the middle of it. So actually, just going into boredom is a really valuable experience. Boredom's quite something. But I do think usually there is some element of qualities there that we are contacting indirectly. So it's worth exploring that aspect. What what I'm left with in the way of questions. So, yeah, let's briefly complete our set of the reminders. So we've had, life is a precious opportunity, an opportunity to awaken. But this body is impermanent, ready or not, one day I shall die. And then there's that, those four lines which come from Tsongkhapa originally. So this life I must know as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Well, it never actually does come into being. It sort of never quite gets that far. It never actually comes into existence. There's just constant dependent arising. You can there's never even a moment where it comes into being long enough to say that it's there in that existent way, but taking it poetically. So the karma I create shapes the course of my life. So that's, actions have consequences. You know, we're constantly creating worlds to live in. So over these 3 days, we've all been at Adhisthana, all under the same basic conditions, and we've all overlapped in all sorts of ways, and in some ways on quite deep levels, we've really come together. And it's very noticeable. You can feel the atmosphere in here and just the sense of connection with everyone on the retreat, you know, regardless of whether you've spoken to them. There's a deeper kind of meeting that's going on. But along with that, there's also a sense that we're all in very different worlds. It's one of the interesting things about doing meditation reviews. You know, all these different worlds walk through the door. And I'd certainly learn a lot from that. Yeah, so we're creating worlds to live in. Through our actions of body, speech, and mind. But then, life always has difficulties. No one can control it all. So this is a way of putting the fourth reminder, which traditionally would be called something like the shortcomings of samsara. And if you read traditional texts from the Indo-Tibetan tradition on this one, very often this is where they go through the six realms, and sometimes in great detail. A friend of mine went on a weekend with renowned Tibetan Lama, a woman known as Jetsun Kushla, who's Tibetan. She lives in Canada and very highly regarded. And she spent the entire weekend exploring and teaching on the hells. Yeah, they had the hot hells, the cold hells, the intermediate hells, in great detail. It must have been like, who knows what it was like, I wasn't there. But it was, yes, it must have been like, you know, kind of going into a part of a Hieronymus Bosch painting or something like that, and really having it all expounded and explained for you. So if we're going to look at it this from our point of view, yes, we all create worlds to live in. Yes, we can create all kinds of worlds to live in. We can create a hell for ourselves. We can create a ghost realm, we can create an animal realm, a human realm, a titan realm, a deva realm. Yeah. In a way, when we're in Dhyana, we've created a deva realm. We've entered a deva realm. Bhante talks about how sort of each mental state, you know, sort of has a kind of corresponding kind of world to it. So if you're in a dhyanic state, then the as it were, inverted commas, objective counterpart of that is one of the deva realms. But I think probably the most practical way, the most useful way for most of us to approach this is to look at where we fantasize or crave being, where we think we can actually sort of settle down and make ourselves happy in samsara, so to speak. Not that samsara is a place, samsara is a state of mind. It's a way we use our minds. It's not like samsara is here and nirvana is over there somewhere. We can use our minds in a samsaric way or a nirvanic way. But yes, very often there's some kind of sense that if only we could just change the conditions, we would get samsara to work for us. We would create a situation where we would be entirely happy. So whatever, if you got the job, the money, the house, the car, the lover, or whatever, you know, whatever it is for you. Yeah. When you've got all those things in a row, you know, then you would be happy. Yeah. If only, you know, there's all those, if only this, if only that, then I'd be happy. Yeah. So it's trying to get you to look into all of that and see, well, no, sorry. Yeah. Real happiness can only come from a mind that sees and understands how things are, and a heart that's open to all life. That's where real happiness is going to come from, not from anywhere else. No, accept no substitutes. Which doesn't mean that, you know, we can't set up conditions that are helpful and that we can't enjoy anything out of worldly life, but it's what we're really placing our heart on. So we're trying to find a true refuge and let go of the false refuges, because the false refuges, again, they kind of pull at us. They take away the energy. You know, if we're really convinced that, you know, we can't make samsara work, we'll stop trying to make it work, and we'll let go of the if onlys, and we'll just go for, you know, what is actually a refuge, what is actually safety, what is actually happiness. But our minds still keep on creating, you know, we're back to fantasy. Yes, if I, my younger self, maybe back in my 20s, you know, on some retreat with some really nice looking girl over there, you know, there would be this thing, if only we could get together and it would all be so good and da da da, and all that. And of course it took energy out of feeling, well, no, it's really down to me to meditate and work with my mind and practice ethics and all that. That's where the happiness was going to come from, the real fulfillment. So when I look at what I did and still do, probably in smaller ways, what I see is that I kind of create, it's like watching a film. You come to a point where you close in on what you want. And then you get what you want and you stop there. It's like you pause the video. Just at that point where, now that's really happy. And partly it allows you to have a sense of, it's a way for us, a not very effective way for us to give our minds, our minds get a sense of, it's like a mini moment of fulfillment when we get to that point. So our minds like that, which is partly why we keep doing it. But what we don't ever do often is we don't carry on, we don't press the resume. Yeah. And if we press the resume, then what happens? Okay, so here we are with the perfect life, but then things carry on and what was perfect now doesn't feel quite so perfect 5 years on. We're used to it and now we want something else maybe, because that's what our minds are like. We're a bit, first off it's great and then it's pretty good and then we're a bit bored and then we have, we get the new thing, we get excited about getting a new whatever, a new computer or a new something or other, and then you get it and 4 years later, 3 years later, 4 years later, it's that old computer and it's time to think about getting a better one, another one. So you just go through the whole cycle. So you don't just stop at the point where, everything's just right and the violins are playing and, because, life isn't like one of those movies where at that point, it's like those old sort of Hollywood movies where, there's just this perfect moment and then it sort of fades and it's just the end. Life isn't like that. It carries on and it just carries on and it carries on. And even if we manage to set up conditions, so we really are, everything is great. And there's nothing bothering us, nothing irritating, we're just really happy. That deals with level one of three levels of dukkha. So level one is dukkha-dukkha, which is the suffering of suffering, where things are actually stressful, unpleasant. We feel friction between how we want things to be and how they are. So that only leaves the other two. So the second level is viparinama dukkha, which is the suffering of change, it's sort of potential dukkha. Because we're holding on to things being like this, being this way, given that everything is impermanent, life flows on, at some point either we won't want it anymore and now we've landed with it, or we do really want it and we're holding on to it and it will go. And at that point we suffer. So we're just, we're holding on to suffering. If we're holding on tight to something, we're holding on to suffering. It just hasn't happened yet. And then there's still even the third level of dukkha, which is skanda dukkha. It's the dukkha of being identified with the five skandhas, which is actually the dukkha of being within a subject-object duality. Because as soon as I identify with, there's completely open awareness, but then it loses track of its own nature and it identifies with this body, these feelings, and so on. The six elements, the five skandhas, however you want to carve it up. Yeah. this bit here. So as soon as I'm identified with this, I'm not identified with everything else. No. So everything else has become other. Everyone else, everything else is other. So that creates a divide. Not a real divide, because it's never ever there, but it creates a sense of split, a sense of separation, and that sense of separation is a deep dukkha. That sense that somehow, you know, of being isolated, separate, cut off, there's a sort of, yeah, an existential dukkha in that. Somehow we feel we're not quite at home in life. We're not quite at home. It's almost like we're not quite part of life fully. And yeah, and all the kind of craving and aversion come out of that, because, you know, all that is the reaction to that tension between subject and object. So yes, even if, you know, we get the perfect job, the perfect home, the perfect this, the perfect that, the perfect whatever, still we have those two sorts of dukkha to deal with. So if we really see this, then we see the real source of the whole wheel of life. And then we start really going for where we can become truly happy, which is working with the mind, working with ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Setting up helpful conditions, but helpful conditions for that work to go on. External conditions are very important, you know. But their purpose is to enable us to free ourselves from this self-created prison of being isolated, separate, and therefore constantly wanting something else, constantly existentially anxious, and so on. That's what we have to fix. And actually, that's fantastic that it is like that. You know, because if real happiness lay in, you know, getting the perfect job, the perfect house, the perfect this, well, good luck, you know. But thankfully, it relies on something which is completely at home. It relies on our own work with ourselves, with our own hearts, with our own minds, with our own awareness, with our own body. So if we really see that, then, yeah, we see the shortcomings of that samsaric approach. And that will free a lot of energy. And that energy can go into further momentum in the direction of what will really make us happy. And we'll be able to help other people too with that whole adventure. Okay, I didn't seem to have gone on a bit, but there we are. So, is that clear? You get the picture? Again, this is a reminder, so I'm probably just telling you things you already know, but it's constant reminders seem to be part of the Dharma. So let's have a little break. Let's, again, but more of a leg stretch break than anything else. Maybe just like 10 minutes or so. And then we'll come back and we'll do some meditation.